Welcome to a routing-focused episode of Software Gone Wild. Today, we'll go deep into host routing with our special guest and let that remain a secret for the next 10 milliseconds. And with me is Bob McCouch. Bob, how are you doing?
I'm doing wonderful.
So how's work? How's life?
Things are great. I just got back from Cisco Live here in the U.S. So that was a good time. A week at Nerd Summer Camp, as I often hear it referred to.
Oh, yeah, that's true. So how was Cisco Live?
It was really good. A lot of focus on software-defined solutions, as you'd imagine. I did a lot of my focus on small-scale data center design, since that's where I spent a lot of my time. But a lot of good information out there. You know, automation was really a big topic this year, as you would expect. And Cisco's really amped up the presence of the what they call the DevNet Zone, which is their focus on network development and automation orchestration, that sort of thing. So, by the looks of the show, Cisco is certainly embracing those topics and trying to push that message across the attendee base. So that's nice to see.
Oh, next on the list, they'll embrace white box switching, right?
Well, they did. Didn't they announce the Nexus 3200 that actually uses Oni?
Oh, did they?
Yeah. Now, I don't know if you can use Oni to load anything else on it yet, but they list Oni as one of the features of that model.
Oh, yeah, that's true. They have Oni, but you can only boot Nexus OS or something through Oni.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. Which brings me, by the way, to our today's special guest. With us is Dinesh Dutt from Cumulus Networks. Dinesh, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you for having me on this. Hi, Bob.
Hello.
Let me do a brief intro to today's topic. I think it all started with one of those crazy blog posts of mine where I was talking about layer 3 only networks. Is that correct, Dinesh?
Yeah. I mean, I had come up with this particular idea, but yes, you and I have had been doing some telepathic messaging for a while now.
Well, yeah. Things usually work this way. I don't know why.
Yes.
Anyway, every time I start the layer 3 only data center discussion, someone inevitably says, well, I love this idea, but I still have to have this bloody VLAN between two top-of-rack switches because my servers can't have two IP addresses. And can't we solve that somehow using layer 3 switching? And just as I was about to write a reply to one of those, Dinesh comes along saying, I have a solution. And so I said, yeah, we need to do a podcast on this. So here we are today. Dinesh, what are you doing in this area?
So we primarily are focused on data center networks. And in the data center networks, the future is all layer 3, but there are still a lot of people with layer 2. And people in networking, as one of my colleagues likes to say, suffer from the Stockholm syndrome. We love what we are, our own captors. And L2 networks, for a lot of reasons, has become very predominant and has stayed predominant as a way for people to build networks. And as you were talking about in one of your more recent blog posts, Ivan, the notion of if I'm a small network, if I'm a small data center, I'm not one of these mega-scale data centers, I don't have the ability to lose an entire top of rack and keep going. I do want to keep my top of rack alive. What do I do then? My typical answer is to have a host with dual NICs connected to two top of racks. In that situation, the answer so far has always been that the host does bonding and you run something like an MLAG towards the host. This was something that we have been trying to avoid, saying like we should be able to build a pure L3 network. There may be certain constraints, but you ought to be able to build it. And so that's what we've been, that this was one of the things that came up in with as part of a customer meeting.
Okay, so you actually got a request from the customer saying, hey, please help me get rid of the VLANs.
The specific request from the customer was, look, I'm not doing MLAG. However, I have active-passive. But even when I do active-passive, it's a financial customer. Financial customers apparently don't like to run bonding always because they want a dedicated and assured 10 gig bandwidth rather than 20 gig bandwidth from the servers that drops to 10 gig when there's a link failure. So they keep an active passive model. But in the active passive model, still the link between the top of rack and the server needs a link between the two top of racks. And this customer's request was, look, every time I have an extra dependency between systems, instead of loose coupling, I have tight coupling. Every time that link fails, I got to go deal with it. It does not happen often, but I have to still deal with it. Can you give me a pure L3 solution? And I said, sure. And we talked about it for a couple of minutes. And then I said, why don't we do redistribute ARP?
Okay, before we go into the details,
yes,
let me just step back a little bit for people who are not that aware with the server world. Let's simplify and say we are talking about physical servers. Virtualization is a totally different beast.
Let's start there.
Yeah. On a physical server, you could have two uplinks and you put them into a port channel, which when terminated on two switches, you use MLAG, right?
Yes.
And you guys do support MLAG, if I remember correctly, from the Data Center Fabrics webinar, right?
Yes.
But if I don't do a port channel, then there are like three or four different things I can do on Linux. One is active-passive.
Yes.
The other one is active-passive on receive but transmitting from both, right?
Yes.
And the third crazy thing is where I use different ARP replies for different neighbors so that I force both of my MAC addresses into the ARP cache of my partners.
Right. There are these four different modes, and I forget whether it is transmit on one and receive on both, or receive on both and transmit only on one. I forget the
modes. No, you can only receive on one because that's the MAC address that's in ARP caches of everyone else.
Right. I'm not sure about transmit because I don't know if the MAC addresses, you get into MAC address flipping if there is, for whatever reason, a layer 2 network above you.
You just transmit with both MAC addresses.
I see. Separate MAC addresses. Yeah.
So basically, there's active standby and then all the ones you shouldn't do, right?
Yeah. Well, that's a good summary.
Yeah. All the ones that don't get done, I haven't seen them deployed at least.
Yeah. But in all cases, the problem is that we have one IP address on the host.
Yep.
And we have two MAC addresses on two uplinks, and we can't associate one IP address with two MAC addresses. That doesn't work.
Yep.
Okay. And now you come along saying I can fix that.
Yeah. So also more precisely to the point that you are making, it's not just on Linux. VMware also in their ESX allow you to do MAC pinning, which is to run active passive. So certain MACs are on the left link and certain MACs are on the right link, for example. And I believe Windows supports it as well. So the ability to do active passive is supported by more than just Linux.
Yeah, but now that you mentioned ESX, in that case, both links are actually active, but every link is active for one MAC address and the other link is passive for that MAC address.
Exactly.
It's like the story we just went through, just by MAC address, not by host.
Exactly.
Or there are other mechanisms, and whoever wants to know about them, hint, hint, there is this VMware networking webinar on my website. Let's move.
Yes. So essentially, the approach that I was looking at was, if the host, one of the models of Cumulus Network is, we are just a server. The model is, even though, you know, it's not really the case, but the model is very much a server with 64 NICs. If you can have a router that's a more that can that has 64 NICs, why is it that I really need to bond from the host to the two top of racks? Bonding is one mechanism of connecting. The other mechanism that is well known to anybody who does layer 3 is ECMP, which is equal cost multipathing. From the server to the two top of racks are equidistant. Why can't I, instead of saying have a default route out only one interface, say have a default route out both interfaces and you're done? Why couldn't we do something like that? And in Linux, we started with the model of there is something called an unnumbered interface where you can assign the same IP address to both interfaces and specify a particular attribute to the default route or to any route for that matter called onlink, which simply says, look, I may not be on a directly connected subnet to the next hop, but trust me, the next hop is on the other side of this link. With a combination of those three factors, which is let's use default route with multipathing, equal cost multipathing, the ability to assign the same IP address to both interfaces, and the ability to say default route with on-link attribute in Linux, I believed we could easily solve the problem of trying to do a dual connect, so a subnet spans two top of racks without requiring bonding.
Okay, now when you say Linux, are you talking about the Cumulus Linux running on the top of rack switch or the Linux running on the attached host?
I'm talking about Linux running on the host.
So you have to do some modification on the host to get ECMP from the host to the network going.
Right. So today, for example, when you do DHCP, DHCP gives you a default gateway, but typically DHCP runs on one interface and the default route points out that interface. Mm-hmm. And so what you would have to do is, if you're running DHCP, for example, on Linux at least, you have the ability to say there are, it comes with an extensibility. So there are things called DH client exit hooks. So in the DH client exit hooks, you put a line which says, instead of making the default route go out just that one interface, make it go out both interfaces.
Okay. So now you have two physical interfaces with two physical MAC addresses.
Yes.
But they happen to have the same IP address.
Yes.
Which means that they can both receive packets.
Yes.
And you have two default routes that are pointing out both interfaces.
Right. In other words, I actually have one default route with two next hops, one pointing out each interface.
Okay. However, it's implemented in the Linux kernel, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, me being a stupid Cisco iOS guy, I would have two default routes in the routing table, but yeah.
Got it. Me being a stupid Linux guy, say that it's default route with two next hops. But yes, I think we're talking the same thing.
Yeah. Now, why would you need that crazy idea of on-link default route?
So let's take a step back with that. Now, if there are two models under which you can operate. The first model in which you operate is you say that I assign the same IP address to both links and I do an Anycast IP address. If I do the Anycast IP address and the subnet that I'm assigning to is a /24, for example, then, you know, I don't need the notion of trying to say, trust me, the next hop is on this link, which is the on-link attribute. However, when you use a /24, you can run into situations whereby you are trying to send an ARP packet and the host that is directly connected to you on the same bridge might move in a virtualized environment, for example. There are certain situations where you might prefer that packet always gets routed, not bridged, even within the same VLAN almost, so to speak. So what you do is you essentially say that the host is getting a /32 address, not a /24 address. At that point, it always talks to the default gateway, which is the top of rack switch. So it's completely routed always. And at that point, you need to be able to tell that the next hop is on the other side of the link because there is no connected route, because there is no subnet that is common on that particular link.
Now, Dinesh, how does the L2 encapsulation work there then? Because if the host is masked with a /32, even if you're telling it, trust me, the gateway is on the network, is on that link, you still need the concept of an ARP to retrieve a MAC address to encapsulate the L2?
Absolutely, you do. Yes, you do. So what happens is on the Linux, on the router side, on the top of rack switch side, it can be any top of rack switch. It doesn't really matter. Cumulus Linux does it. Cisco, I know, does it as well with the notion of an anchored interface. You can specify the same IP address on multiple interfaces. At that point, when the host wants to send a packet using the default route, it says the next hop is the default gateway address, which is an Anycast IP address. So it ARPs for that Anycast IP address. And the router on the other side, the top of rack switch on the other side, will respond with the ARP.
It still issues an ARP request using a layer 2 all hosts broadcast.
Yes. Everything works identically. Okay. The only thing is, in Linux, if you attempt to install a route with a next hop that is not on that is not on a connected subnet, meaning it's not on a common subnet on that interface. It says, hey, you're asking me to send a packet out an interface using a next hop IP address that I don't know how to reach out this interface. So you need to specify on link. You say, look, it's not a shared subnet. I understand that the other side has a different subnet than what you do, but ARP for what I'm telling you to ARP for, and you will get a reply.
Okay, now this brings back bad memories. I know that on Linux you have plenty of memory, but once I had a Cisco router where I was using exactly that same trick. So I used a default route pointing to the Ethernet interface, and it crashed after I don't know how many hours because it ran out of memory, because everything it was trying to reach resulted in an ARP entry.
Well, this is kind of the inverse of that, isn't it? You really have, I mean, the gateway wouldn't have any more ARP entries than usual, but you would have a relative explosion in your
on the host
route table. Mm-hmm. Well, no, on the wouldn't the host simply cache the ARP entry of the gateway?
No, if you have on the host a default route that points to an interface, which is what Dinesh, or not?
No, there is a next hop, right?
Exactly.
So you do have a next hop. You just say, well, trust me, this is on link.
Exactly. The next hop IP address still exists.
Okay.
And it is using the same model of Anycast IP and Anycast MAC that you have, that you know you have popularized, that people tend to be comfortable with when they have layer 3 at the top of rack. Because when VMs move, they don't want to necessarily change the next hop IP address.
Okay. So, to summarize, two uplinks on the Linux host. The same /32 IP address on both of them.
Yes.
Two default routes pointing to whatever next hop.
Yep.
And it doesn't actually matter what that next hop is, because the top of rack switch would do proxy ARP anyway.
Yep.
I could use 8888 as the next hop if I wish to.
Totally.
So, two default routes pointing to bogus next hops and saying, well, this is on net, trust me.
Yep.
Okay.
And I, instead of bogus, the word I use is Anycast. And at that point, the top of rack switch responds appropriately, because when it is ARP for that IP address, it says, oh yeah, that's me. Here is my MAC address.
Yeah.
And life works very well.
Yeah.
On the host side, as Bob pointed out, my ARP table contains only one entry, which is the default gateway. That's it.
Yeah, I missed the part where you have the next hop with the default route.
So this is very interesting, because you've basically eliminated broadcast domains then within the data center completely, right?
Yep.
Which has both some, I can think of some good implications and some not good, so good implications, right? I mean, it not that L2 security issues are usually a first order concern in a data center, but all your, you know, if they were, all your L2 security issues, you know, IP spoofing and
it's gone.
ARP poisoning and all that's gone, right?
Yes.
That can't happen.
Yes.
Well, you can still do IP spoofing unless Dinesh can turn on URPF checks.
Exactly.
Which you can, I guess.
Which it's just an L3 interface at that point, right? So
exactly. Yep, exactly.
No, no, Bob, the question is whether Dinesh can put URPF lookup into the code path on the Trident 2 chipset.
Yes, we can. Today, we do not, because it's not an asked feature so far. In all our customers, we have never run into somebody asking us for URPF, but the Trident 2 chipset supports it. The Linux kernel supports it. We just haven't hardware accelerated it.
So if I would stupidly turn on URPF checks on a Cumulus Linux switch, I would turn a 1 terabit switch into a 1 gigabit server.
No, you won't. Essentially, what will happen is only packets that get software forwarded, like control plane packets, would get this particular thing. We don't say like, oh, you've enabled URPF, therefore I'm going to software switch everything. No, it's essentially not hardware accelerated. So packets only that are in the software accelerated path would see it.
So I configure URPF and you go like, I'll just ignore that.
Yep.
Unless I get a BGP packet, in which case I will check that you are okay.
Yes.
That's comforting.
Yes.
I hope you do generate some warnings saying, hey, you did a stupid thing.
Right. So the part about that is essentially the ability for us to go generate warnings for all the possible combinations that people might try on Linux. So that would cause us to have to issue that warning. And we haven't put in warnings for every single possible choice like that. For example, with IP tables, we have the warning because people tend to use ACLs. We tend to issue warnings for people attempting to do things that are not, that cannot be hardware accelerated. We will fail that IP tables installation. But there are lots of little things. I mean, Linux is a pretty humongous amount of software that we don't necessarily issue warnings for everything at this point. It's a work in progress.
So you're giving me plenty of rope to play with.
Yes.
Cool.
I give you plenty of rope to play with. Also, because, see, the other part of it is RPF check. We cannot just directly say, don't do URPF check. If you issue an URPF check, issue a warning. If the URPF check is issued on the management interface, of course, we can. The Linux kernel will enforce it because it's only software switched at that point. It's not getting switched by the hardware. Mm-hmm. So the checking will have to be even more precise. And essentially, the model has been that when we have the equivalent in the Linux kernel of device offload, which today does not exist, but it is being worked on in the Linux kernel, then you can enable all kinds of interesting things that will then trigger the appropriate warnings. You can say like, hey, I cannot hardware offload this feature. So the work is being built into the Linux kernel as part of what is called the Switch Dev project. And when that is all enabled, many of these things will come for free.
We are now totally off track, but doesn't matter.
Yes.
So what you're doing today is you're living sort of in parallel with the Linux kernel.
Yes.
And you're trying to reverse engineer what people have configured in the kernel and push that into the hardware.
So typically what we do is we have this notion of a netlink. Whenever any routing table, bridge table, etc. interface is modified, there's a netlink message issued and we trap the netlink message and then use that to actually go configure the hardware. So we function just like a driver, so to speak. When you say, set my wireless SSID to something, you just set the text. The actual programming of the wireless NIC is done by the driver. So think of the Cumulus Linux driver doing identically.
Ah, okay. So you're using more polite terms than I do.
Yeah. I do have employment issues.
Okay, understood. Sorry.
And I also think I'm characterizing it as a driver because I think in reality we are a driver. It's similar to how you could think of, for example, a graphics driver from what's the company? I forget the company from Intel, for example, or from any of the other graphics chip companies that produce drivers for Linux, which could be binary blobs because of their own IP. So similarly, we have a binary blob from Broadcom, which we interface with using our own API so that we could tomorrow interface with other platforms, other ASIC manufacturers, so to speak. Today, we are primarily Broadcom. So it's a binary blob driver similar to the graphics drivers.
Sure. Okay, now let's go back to the original.
Yes.
So we fixed the host side of things.
Yes.
The host has the same IP address on both uplinks, so it's happily sending the packets to the network.
Yep.
What about the return path?
So the return path is identical. So you have two particular choices, and this is where we will get into the question. If the top of rack switches announce a subnet route up, which is a /24, then the rest of the network, which is running layer 3, will say, hey, I have two ways to reach the /24. And it just uses that /24 to get to one of the two top of racks connected to the server and then is delivered to the server. Ooh, life is beautiful.
Unless, of course, one of the uplinks from the server fails.
Exactly. Which then brings you back because at that point, it is a layer 2 problem because you have said you know how to reach the subnet. And the subnet you're announcing is a /24, so it's almost like a summary route. What you will need is a link between the two top of racks to cross to get to the server. And now we are back to the original problem that the customer said he wanted to get out of, which is he didn't want any links between the two top of racks. To avoid that problem, what you would have to do is essentially announce a /32 route.
For every host.
For every host. And this leads to a problem, which is, what are there all of the hosts present? How do I know what hosts are present? Because some are down, some are up, which leads to the whole fundamental problem that people say, hey, I cannot announce /32s because I don't know what hosts are there.
Oh, but you do know, right?
Exactly. We do know. That was exactly my insight. I said, we do know. The way you know is you look at the ARP table. The ARP table tells you what /32s are present. So now in routing, there's a very well-known construct called redistribute, which essentially says, take routing information that you learn from one protocol, whether that protocol is, say, OSPF, RIP, or it could be statically, added routes, and push that information and advertise it in another protocol. For example, OSPF's routes are announced via BGP, or RIP's routes are announced via OSPF, static routes are announced via BGP, etc. I said, ARP, in some sense, is a host routing protocol, if you want to think of it like that. And now, if you just do redistribute ARP, you have the ability to say, I can announce only those /32s that are present, not everything.
Now,
redistribute ARP.
You remember that command, Bob, right? It was in Cisco iOS 20 years ago.
Yeah, it's funny. I remember a frighteningly similar, shouldn't say frightening, I remember a similar technology, kind of a precursor to IP mobility that iOS used to support.
It was mobile IP, yeah.
It was sort of a precursor to that. It was,
I think it was called mobile IP.
LAM. It was LAM. It was local area mobility. And it basically, it was exactly that, right? It would basically proxy ARP for any host that appeared to be off its own subnet and then redistribute a /32 into the dynamic routing protocol.
Interestingly, I did not know this, but I was talking with Tony Lee the other day. Tony Lee, I presume you all know.
The Tony Lee, yeah.
The Tony Lee. He's a friend of mine, and he and I were having lunch the other day. And I told him, hey, Tony, I got a really cool idea. Here is what I did. And he looked at me sadly and said, Dinesh, I did that 20 years ago.
Exactly.
So, yeah, you're right. But I was not aware of the local area mobility feature at all till he mentioned it to me.
Yeah, I actually ran into it not so many years ago at a hospital that needed it for medical devices, MRI machines and portable ultrasounds and things like that. But we used to get in trouble with that because if we had two routers on the segment, they would end up proxy ARPing. Because one of the things that LAM would do was when the ARP entry, periodically it would basically ARP again for that host to make sure the host was still there, right? To make sure the host was still alive if the host wasn't talking.
And the other router would proxy ARP.
Two proxy ARPing routers on the same subnet would just keep tricking each other and they would just, it would get stuck. Go clear the ARP.
But they were using a single broadcast domain, I presume.
Correct. Yeah. What that was if the host showed up on essentially the wrong subnet, right?
Right.
So I think your solution here wouldn't be subject to that because it's not a common broadcast domain.
And what was the use case for local area mobility?
No, I don't.
Replace the thick Ethernet cable with a router.
Yes.
Really?
Interesting.
I actually had an installation like that and it all worked because we only had one AGS plus sitting in the middle.
I see. So this kind of makes me feel somewhat good because it's stuff that when Tony Lee said that, as sad as I was by the fact that I was not that clever after all, it also made me feel like, hey, this is a solution that has been attempted before and it works actually quite well. And a few days later, I saw Juniper show up with a draft called Labeled ARP. And I said, oh, so other people are thinking similarly.
Yeah, there is only so many ways to solve a problem.
Exactly. At the end of the day, that is precisely the point. There are only so many ways to solve the problem, but it is a fairly robust solution for people who either are running, DHCP-based hosts using Linux, where they'll be able to modify the route given so that they can issue the default route, or they are statically configured, whether it's Windows or VMware ESX, they all work fine. Because in all of those cases, if it's not DHCP, in case of Windows, for example, you have the ability to specify multipath default routes.
Now, thinking about DHCP. How can you force the same IP address onto both uplinks on a Linux host through DHCP?
So what DHCP will do is you can ARP for using the same, you can ARP out both, I mean, you can DHCP out both interfaces if you like. Alternately, you can ARP, DHCP out one interface, but using the DH client exit hooks mechanism, you can write a little script. And that script essentially does the following. It says the IP address that I've received on interface one, I will also apply the same IP address on interface two. And then say that the default route, instead of just being the default route that was given going out the interface that I received the DHCP response on, it actually goes out both interfaces. So it's one script that does both the things.
Yeah, nice.
If you're using DHCP, you would do that script, and it's a pretty trivial script, and it works pretty well.
So you effectively just do your DHCP transaction on a single interface and then apply the resulting configuration to both interfaces.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And alternately, what you could also choose to do if you want to preserve this IP address and not let it die, you could, instead of assigning it to either one of the physical interfaces, you could assign that to the loopback. And at that point, it looks almost exactly like a router. A host looks exactly like a router. It has a loopback IP address, so the IP address stays, and then you have the two DHCP, you have the two Ethernet interfaces out which the same IP address is assigned, so it's like an anchor interface, the loopback, but the link going down on any one of the links going down will not take out the IP address on the other.
Yeah, but then you would need, so you have the same IP address on all three interfaces.
Exactly.
Okay, so you're not running a routing protocol on the Linux host.
Nope.
Good.
Yep. So there is a way, if you want, you could always run a routing protocol, and we can get into that discussion as well about running a routing protocol on a host. But this is a mechanism whereby without running any routing protocol, without changing anything, you use ARP as the mechanism to get notified about your /32s.
By the way, another history trip. Do you support ISIS on your top-of-rack switches?
Nope.
Okay, because if you were to support ISIS, then you would have totally reinvented CLNS.
See, Ivan, I knew that I didn't want to totally reinvent CLNS because I know where it went. So I didn't do ISIS. We didn't do ISIS.
Yeah, and you're using ARP instead of ESIS.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yes. As you say, now, these are all ideas that are pretty, you know, there are only so many ways you can slice this pie. So, yep.
So, Dinesh, I can imagine, you know, there are certainly some implications, I think, to essentially treating every host as its own subnet. So I'm thinking of things like, you know, how about multicast routing, right? Wouldn't your multicast state tables explode because you've got that many more segments you're routing onto? Right? Do things like that become a problem?
So multicast in general, if you're going to do multicast, then you would have to implement a layer 3 multicast routing protocol equivalent and be able to do something similar. And there are ways to solve that particular problem. But yes, you would have to do something like that. You're right. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. The general deployments that we have seen in the data center where people are willing to run things like this are not multicast savvy. They don't run multicast. I mean, as I progress, it's only in the older data centers that I see multicast. In most of the more modern data centers, I don't see as much multicast. But in short, you're right. If you run multicast, then this is a solution that would require you to use layer 3 multicast and the implied explosion in state.
Right. And even, I'm sure you know this off the top of your head, what's the how many routes can be held in a Trident 2 chipset? And does that become a scalability concern in a data center?
No, not really, because essentially, so there are two parts to this equation. So when you look at a modest size data center, you're not looking at web scale company data centers, but if you're looking at a modest size data center, then, you know, you say that how many racks do I have? I have 16 racks, 32 racks. The question becomes, how do you break them into failure domain so that a failure does not take down an entire, you know, the whole system, because you could have systemic failures that take down the entire pod. Instead of that, people tend to break them up into multiple pods, so to speak. just to avoid a single systemic failure. But in general, the Trident 2 chipset has about 32,000 host-based entries, and the longest prefix match table in case of Trident 2 is 128,000. So plenty big.
Plenty, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I do, you know, I can also think of some situations where certain applications or appliances are really expecting layer 2 adjacency with, you know, peers for active standby type or clustered applications, right? You know, I think of load balancers or firewalls or various application clustering technologies that anticipate that two hosts can see each other really with basically a, you know, a link level adjacency for some sort of link local multicast they're sending or something like that. Do you have a solution for that, or is that sort of an open question for this design?
So like I said earlier, I have not really tackled the multicast problem, because in the places where people are using redistribute ARP, it's being still in pre-trial phases. It's in trial phases. It's not something that people have deployed in production yet. But in all of those situations that people are considering using it, there has been no multicast. So I have not really gone to the multicast aspect of the problem.
I think there are ways to solve it. Usually in like that application type clustering environment, the link local multicast is effectively a broadcast. It's just not a broadcast that everyone cares about, right?
Right. And is there a way we could take that and potentially convert it into a link level, forward it out the other ports which belong to the same subnet, so to speak? There are all various ways we can play those tricks, but so far we haven't done anything in Cumulus Linux to address those specific multicast issues. One thing you can do, however, is to simply say that what I will do is put all the ports that belong to the same VLAN, so to speak, in a bridge on the switch side, on the top of rack switch side. And at that point, the link local multicast will still be forwarded between all hosts in the same VLAN. But you would have to suppress ICMP redirect. But because when you're trying to reach somebody and you ARP, it will get to the router and the router will see this particular ARP. As long as you're not, if you're ARPing for the router will say, hey, why are you trying to reach me? That host is actually on your subnet. So you can reach them directly because of the default route. Maybe I should step back and explain this step by step.
Yeah, too.
So to address the problem of link local multicast, if you say that, hey, I do have some limited multicast, can you address that without having to do anything more fancy? One solution, the reason why right now the link local multicast is not actually getting propagated to the other nodes in the same subnet, so to speak, is because we have said that the subnet is a /32 or a /31. If instead you say on the top of rack switch that it's actually a /24, not a /32, then what will happen is you will have the packets being forwarded by the top of rack switch, multicast packets on the top of rack switch, forwarded to all the ports in the same bridge, in the same VLAN, so to speak. Because at that point, what the top of rack switch sees is not a single port that's connected, but a bridge. So a VLAN, essentially. So at that point, it will go everywhere. But now the top of rack switch cannot have a /32. It would typically have a /24 as its subnet, and a slash, you know, it would have a specific IP address on that subnet. All the hosts have been told that you only have a default gateway. The default gateway is pointing up to the top of rack switch. If they ARP for somebody in their own subnet to the top of rack switch, a typical response that any router does is it sends an ICMP redirect, meaning, hey, that guy is already on your subnet. Don't ARP for him.
I think it actually happens in the data plane, so when the first packet is sent, but yeah, the same idea.
Yeah. And instead of there are ways to fix this as well, and I'm thinking aloud right now. If you say that, for example, all the hosts receive a /24, meaning for everything within the local subnet, they do ARP for each other and can communicate with each other, thereby enabling link local multicast. Multicast within the same VLAN will all work fine. But upwards, I will still announce a /32 using redistribute ARP. that part will still work fine, because essentially the notion of redistribute ARP is not what the two top of rack switches who are connected to the servers are understanding. It's essentially what the rest of the world understands on how to reach those servers. If the rest of the world thinks, oh, they are individual slash 32s, so I see two equal cost paths to the two top of rack switches, life will still work pretty well, and you can have slash 24s instead of slash 32s, and everything will work equally well in that model and support link local multicast.
But don't we then come right back to having to essentially connect at layer two of the top rack switches?
Yeah, we would have to.
Yes.
Because the moment you allow one host to have another host's MAC address in its ARP cache, you get into problems if one of the links fail.
Right. Because you may have a case where you have to traverse between the two top of rack switches, right?
Yeah.
Well, we're making progress then. So we've finished reinventing CLNS, and now we're reinventing Ethernet and VLANs.
I'm just thinking about that. Is that really true? Because the two, so if I look at the server has two NICs. Now I'm thinking aloud because, like I said, we have not been using this with multicast. I'm thinking aloud to solve the problem on the fly. The two servers have two links going up to the two top of racks. There is no layer two link between the two top of racks at all. Everything between the two top of racks is directly host connected, and that's it.
Yeah, and now imagine that server A is talking to server B through top of rack 1.
Yeah, I can see that the ARP goes out one way,
yeah,
and you have to forward it out to the guy in the other way.
Yeah.
So you would have to solve it. Yeah,
the problem is if server B now loses the link to top of rack 1.
Yep, mm-hmm. Yep. Then you have the issue that you will have to respond appropriately.
Yeah, the problem is that the other server has stale ARP entry and it will not even query.
Yep, exactly.
Now that we got down this all rabbit trails of ARP, this solution works great if you have the same IP address on both server uplinks.
Yes.
But what if I have a floating IP address, like two load balancers? And when one of them fails, the other one takes over the IP address and obviously sends a gratuitous ARP. So you see it in the ARP entry, but you also see the other ARP entry, which is now stale.
Right. So the particular problem that you talk about floating IP also can happen when you have a host that moves. For example, if we have tested this with VMs as well, and it works quite well with VMs using KVM as an example, or even Hyper-V. VMware's ESX issues not a gratuitous ARP, it issues a RARP.
I know. Don't tell me about that.
Okay, I will stop right now before I get into more trouble.
makes me sick.
Yes. So,
how cheap can you be?
You know, I think somebody was thinking they were being very clever because they were only sending the packet that really mattered. But anyway.
No, they were too lazy to clean the IP address of the host.
Yes, I agree with you. Let's everybody else other than VMware's ESX sends a gratuitous ARP. And therefore, when the VM moves, now you have the situation of the floating IP that you pointed out, Ivan, which is there is one entry on a particular host, which is saying like, hey, this guy is directly connected to me. So the ARP entry is being announced from that top of rack switch. But now another top of rack switch says, hey, I learned this IP address, and it's announcing the ARP entry from that top of rack switch. The typical model that we do at this point right now is, and that is why it's an experimental feature and we are working on hardening it, is the ability to then say, if I receive a slash 32 information from somebody other than myself, I will send an ARP out again to make sure that it is actually responding. And if it does not respond, I will time it out right away.
That's the right way to do it, yeah.
Yes. So right now, it's a Python script. If you look at the Python script, if you install the package, you look at the Python script, it's written using Python. It's pretty small script. To do this redistribute ARP. In fact, the original version we did just using Bash. We just piped the output of IP monitor, looked at it, and stuck information in. So it worked just to demonstrate the feature, so to speak.
So we put Linux on the box so that we could implement local area mobility with Bash.
Yes, exactly. So Bash is your programming language now. But the basic idea is essentially that, right? I mean, many of these things, when you explain a particular concept to a customer, so this particular customer, for example, said, oh, really? I can just do it? And so they went away and they wrote the little Bash script and tried it out. And they said, yeah, this actually works. Now, if you can kind of harden it and so that if I find a bug, I can actually file it with you, make it work, I'll be happy to proceed. But the fact that they could actually try it out by themselves made it very easy for them to say, oh, yeah, this works.
Hang on. So the customer actually wrote the Bash script.
We told them what to do. I mean, just pipe IP monitor output and look at the result. Yes.
Awesome.
So this was clearly a very savvy customer that they could just go write a Bash script. But that was pretty much it. I mean, look at the IP monitor, look for the subnet, and essentially push that route into the main routing table. And then within the Quagga, which is the open source routing suite that Cumulus Linux uses to do routing, control protocols, that is, we essentially said, redistribute the information from this table. So the exact model that Linux, the Quagga model follows is, the redistribute app follows is the following. The Linux kernel supports multiple routing tables. We pick one of the routing tables, and whatever entries we learn from the app, we push into this non-main routing table. Inside Quagga, we essentially say, import the routes from this routing table with a distance. Because when you're having multiple routing protocols, there is a notion of an administrative distance. So if OSPF and BGP both announce the same route, you want to make sure that you pick the OSPF's route, not the BGP's route, because it is administrative distance. The same thing between IBGP and EBGP.
So they copied iOS.
Right. So that is there in Quagga. So we said, since we want to provide an equivalent functionality, we allow you the choice to specify a distance. So you can decide if you want ARP to be overridden by BGP or somebody else. But essentially, or you make them equivalent, so both of them can be installed as multipathing routes. So we allow the ability to say that import routes from this separate routing table into the main routing table and redistribute it using BGP or OSPF. And that's the when everything happens. So what this customer essentially was doing was reading this routing information, checking that the subnet that they wanted to look at was what they wanted to push into this routing table, and they pushed it into that routing table. And in Quagga, we added the ability to import routes, and they could do what they wanted.
Nice.
This gives you the ability to control it, because one of the things we didn't want to happen is also that you had this particular Python script going crazy. So we said, let it sit on the side and put it in somewhere else, and we can control using our own mechanisms, the standard well-known routing mechanisms, that you would not end up polluting the routing table if you didn't want to.
And then I guess the assumption is then that at the fabric edge, you would simply summarize all of these routes into the data center subnet, and so that your WAN router and things of that nature aren't polluted with 50,000/32s.
It's not even, you don't even have to go all the way to the edge. If you're building a three-tier class network, you can summarize at the second tier spine itself.
Sure, sure.
So that way you can say that your mobility is restricted to within a pod, and your pod is as big as you want it to be. And I think with something like 16,000 host table entries /32s is not a big deal for BGP to push around. And then you say that above that I summarize, and now you get the ability to get mobility and dual connection in a fairly large network as well, with the ability to summarize beyond the pod. And things work pretty effectively, even in terms of scaling now.
The one thing is still bothering me. So you said when the IP address moves, you still have the ARP entry, you still have the /32 in this separate routing table. You're getting an update from the other end. And that update also has a /32. So now you have to go like, oops, let me check the local ARP entry.
Correct.
I can see this working with OSPF, but how do you make this work through BGP?
Oh, Ivan. So let me kind of take a step back and make sure I understand your question. Your question is the following. Today, if you deploy BGP in the data center, what you do is you give the inter-pod spine or even the pod spine the same AS number, which means if I summarize from any of the spines, it is the routing within the total network, so to speak, is always an simple up-down routing.
Yep.
So packets from the top of rack can go to the pod spine and they can only go down from there. It is not possible to bounce off of other nodes, other top of racks, in case your link is gone. So let's just take a step back and see if I can visualize, say this visually from a podcast perspective. If I have two top of racks, T1 and T2, and I have two leaves, L1 and L2, if L1 and L2 summarize the route to the spine, but now L1 loses the route to T1, the spine will send it to L1. But L1 now does not know how to forward that packet because it has lost its link to T1. And this particular /32 is hanging off of T1. What does it do now? Now you're toast. And now you end up black holing traffic. Yeah. How do you address this with BGP is your question, Ivan, correct?
Well, no, you opened a totally different can of worms. My can of worms was slightly simpler.
Okay.
The idea was, I am announcing a /32.
Yes.
And now this other guy starts announcing /32. And now I have to receive his /32 so that I know that I need to check my ARP entry.
Correct.
But if I have a route reflector in the middle, which would be usually the case, the route reflector might say, well, I prefer the older route over the newer one, which is the usual rule with the route reflectors. So it will not even send the new /32 to the original guy. Unless you're using addpath.
Yes. Unless we are using addpath, that is one answer to the solution. The other answer is, instead of route reflectors, if everything is running as eBGP, then you would get the announcement from the other guy because you're doing something called multipath AS relax.
The same thing as addpath, but on eBGP.
Exactly, but without requiring addpaths to be enabled.
Yeah, because that is a local functionality of the spine router. You don't need
addpath. Exactly.
Yeah.
So you get that information and you can then do the, I'm again restricting pretty much everything to the mobility is present only within, if you are, for example, in the particular case we are talking about, Ivan, the top of rack, leaf and spine. If you say that those are the three layers, I'm restricting the mobility to just the leaf.
The bottom two layers, yeah.
Exactly, because you don't want, otherwise everything is a /32 everywhere.
You don't want that.
Yes, exactly. So does that answer your can of worms, Ivan?
Oh, yeah. And what was your can of worms?
So my can of worms is, if you look at how there is this popular draft by Peter Lapukov about how to use eBGP in the data center.
Yes.
And the way they do that is on the leaf, at every summarizable point, which is not the lowest layer, they essentially give everybody the same AS number. So they make essentially eBGP almost act like a route reflector.
Yeah.
And at that point, all you get is a simple up-down routing. Packets that go up can only come down. They cannot come down and go up again.
Because the AS path loop prevention would effectively kill those routes. Yeah.
Exactly. So at that point, if you summarize from the leaf to the spine, from the second layer to the third layer in the class topology, then you have the issue that if I lose a link between the second layer and the first layer, having summarized, what happens if I receive a packet for the /32? Don't I have a problem?
Yes, you do.
To avoid that particular problem without messing up BGP, the answer is essentially, you also have all of the top of racks announce a /24. So when the leaf loses a /32, because it essentially lost connectivity to that particular first hop switch, the top of rack switch, it has a /24, which it can use to send to one of the other boxes.
And then it randomly sprays the packet to whoever, and that whoever has a /32 pointing up to the other,
yes,
you call them leaf switches, so the second level
yes.
switches, and that other,
and they will come back.
Okay, so you go around in almost circles, but you get there eventually.
You get there eventually, yes. But you are absolutely right. OSPF solves with OSPF; it's somewhat more elegant.
And by the way, just to make sure the listeners aren't confused, and we should have inserted this like 15 minutes ago, in reasonably sized data centers, we usually only see two layers of switches. So we talk about leaf and spine.
Exactly.
And you are spoiled brat, and you work with mega-sized data centers. So you talk about leaf and spine and top of rack.
Correct.
Which is like three layers because you're used to dealing with the big stuff.
Right. We are used to dealing with small stuff as well, but I was just trying to make it clear that people who are dealing with big stuff can also look at something like this. That's all. But you're right.
Yeah. And I'm so jealous.
But, you know, honestly, to come back to this, Ivan, your specific point is very valid, which is, I think a lot of this is, goes back to, again, to tie back to your blog post where you asked about ISSU. If people have very large data centers, they don't want to dual connect NICs. All of these things that we are talking about don't typically come into play at all.
True.
It's the smaller data centers that care about it. They say we want to go to L3, but because we can't afford the loss of a single top of rack, we dual connect our servers. Now, if you want to do L3, how do we go about it? Those guys have a very simple topology, which is a two-tier topology. And for them, things work far more simply, whether it's BGP or OSPF. Everything works very cleanly from that perspective.
Totally agree.
And this is back to your point, Bob, which is at that point, it's only the Vantage which gets a summarized route because there is nobody else to summarize.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think we've beaten this horse to death.
Actually, last question is this something that that we might expect to see, you know, in some way develop into a standard for interoperability, or is this are our vendors going to come up with their own special sauce to solve this kind of problem?
I don't know. So one of the things is that we put it out as an experimental feature. We are working on hardening it. Typically, hardening it means subjecting it to all the rigorous QA that we do before we make it a fully supported feature, so to speak, or not fully supported, but a non-experimental feature, to be very precise, because we will support experimental features too. But in any case, coming back, we put this out, and our model with all of this is, look, this is so straightforward, redistribute ARP should just work. I remember talking about this to a bunch of customers. The moment I say redistribute ARP, the light bulb goes off because they know exactly what redistribute means, they know what ARP means, and redistribute ARP just works. In their head, they understand how it might work. So to come back to the question of how would other vendors do it, we encourage everyone to support this kind of a feature. We have pushed out the Quagga, whatever patches we have done with Quagga to support the import table feature have also already been pushed out to our GitHub repository, so it's out there. We have not written an internet draft about this. It's something that we will do as well and, you know, put a pointer to the code. One of the things for me is if I want IETF to go back to the maxim of rough consensus working code instead of just draft by committees, I'd like to start seeing internet drafts with pointers to code as
working
well.
Working code, sure.
Exactly. Yeah. And with one of the work drafts that we put out called BGP hostname, we did do that already, which is put a pointer to the GitHub commit ID. And with this as well, we will do equivalently so that then others can go ahead and implement it as well. And then this becomes a standard feature that you can get from anybody.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, but just to keep this in perspective, what you're doing is effectively an intra-box feature.
Yes.
So it's like BGP weights.
Yes.
You don't need an RFC on this. Well, an informational RFC would be nice.
That's all it is. It's just an informational RFC.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But you don't need an RFC because you're not modifying any protocol or behavior outside of the box.
Bingo. That is why we have not yet written anything so far. We have just put out code. But, you know, to Bob's point, many people like to see it all spelled out. So writing an informational RFC might be interesting.
Yeah, I see it as, you know, I agree that you're not actually fundamentally changing any protocols, but it seems like you're kind of skating the edge of, you know, intended functionality of a lot of things to get to a very clever end. So I think, yeah, having some sort of, you know, something to tie that all together would certainly be helpful for my feeble brain to choke this all down.
I think many people prefer a design spec, so to speak. And if the informational RFC is merely a simple, here is a list of things and here is what we do, not a bad idea.
Now, Dinesh, if people want to know more about this feature, where can they learn more?
So to learn more about this feature, we have a blog post out, and we also have a what is called a knowledge base article, which explains all the commands and everything else. You could also get into what is called the Cumulus Workbench, which is a mechanism whereby you can actually play with real switches without having to buy those switches. But you can test out, see what Cumulus Linux feels like, test out what configuring routing looks like, etc., and test it out there. Those are two or three places where you can do it. I'm trying to write out white paper where you would have this all listed out in far more detail than either the KB or the blog post has. And this podcast, I hope, was a mechanism to reach to more people so that they can be aware of interesting ways in which they can build layer 3 only data centers. So those are some of the ways right now. And the feature itself is available, has been available in our code base for a while. So the latest release of Cumulus Linux 2.5.3 has it as well. It is an experimental feature, which means you need to explicitly enable the experimental feature repo to download the package. But that's about it. You should have it.
Awesome. And if people want to get in touch with you, how can they do that?
Yeah, that's pretty easy. If you Google me, you should be able to find an email address. But otherwise, just go to the website. There must be a link to contact me. I'm on the Twitter as well. DDCumulus is my Twitter handle. You could use that to reach me. Send me email, ddath@cumulusnetworks.com. Multiple ways to reach me.
Perfect. So thank you for this awesome deep dive. I mean, I thought like we would spend 20 minutes on this, and it was like over an hour or so.
So yes. Thank you for coming and hosting this and wanting to talk about this. This is really useful and interesting to see that people actually still enjoy listening to technical deep dive podcasts as opposed to 140-character tweets.
Definitely. And Bob, where can people find you?
Well, you can always find me on Twitter as @BobMcCouch, and I blog with occasional frequency at herdingpackets.net.
Perfect. And I'm Ivan Pepelniak, and if you stumbled upon this podcast by accident, I apologize. I hope you survived. And you can find more podcasts like this one at podcast.ipspace.net. If you're interested in SDN, go to sdn.ipspace.net, where you'll find all sorts of SDN resources. And finally, if you like bloggy rants, go to blog.ipspace.net, where you'll find at least one rant a week. Thank you, and see you next time.